Everyone, hi everyone. I'm Jane, recovering in this program. Grateful to be here. Dear Higher Power, we just invite you into this meeting tonight to welcome all of the newcomers and to welcome all of us together. We're on this boat together. There's no above or below. We are all equal here, and we pray that you help us to set aside everything we think we know about you, about our recovery, and about our fellows, so that we may be open to a new experience and hear the messages that we all came to hear. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. So we have two speakers tonight. The first one is Pat B. from New Jersey. I have known Pat for somewhere between 10 and 20 years. And she was my sponsor for a while, and I think she has a really great message, and I know that everyone is going to be blessed from hearing her. So, go ahead. Welcome, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for that introduction. When Janet, when you first asked me, my first thought was, no, I don't want to do that. But then I always refer to 24 hours a day, October 1st, and it says AA will lose some of its effectiveness if I do not do my share. Where am I failing? Are there some things I do not feel like doing? And I don't feel like doing this. Am I held back by self-consciousness or fear? Self-consciousness is a form of pride, and it's a fear that something may happen to you. And then I love this line: what happens to you is not very important. And that keeps me right-sized. And then October 2nd, it says, what makes an effective talk at an AA meeting? It's not a fine speech with fine choice of words and an impressive delivery. Often a few simple words direct from the heart are more effective than the most polished speech. So, and I also remember what Dr. Bob used to say. He would say, be interesting, but I don't know if that's going to happen. Be brief and be seated. So that's what I go by. So, okay. My mom, I'm the middle child. I have two brothers. And my mom had a terrible experience in the hospital when my older brother was born. So when it came time for me to be born, I was born at home on two kitchen tables. And you really can't even make that up. I mean, that's the truth. I was born on a kitchen table. And I often say that's where it started. My addiction, my food addiction started at birth. I come from a very large family. My mom was one of seven, my dad one of five. And I had about 24 or 25 first cousins. And we were together all the time. But they always wanted to play and be active. And I always wanted to know, when are we going to eat? That was my focus. My dad died in his early 70s from alcoholism and drug addiction. And I always say that my mom got her doctorate in martyrdom. She really suffered. I had suggested Al-Anon a couple times. She came with me, but she said it was too deep. Those were her words. So I let it go. I let it go. So I have come to realize that I'm just wired differently, and I have the disease of addiction, and I always assigned blame for my behavior, and I always gave food power to heal me, and I learned that I am the problem, and then I can be the solution. If I think you are the problem, then I want you to be the solution, and that's not how it works. I joined OA in May of 1976. I often say I was 10 at the time, but I really wasn't, of course. So for 11 years, I could not stay abstinent. I couldn't. And I started making some changes. But I never gave up on OA. I just kept going. So I really thought I had a fat problem and I needed a good diet. And that if I were thin, everything would be wonderful. And I thought that also with my family too, you know, if the alcoholics in my life would just stop drinking, then everything would be wonderful. And I was the problem. It was how I perceived things. It was how I looked at things. So, like I said, it was about 11 years that I was in program. So in 87, I became willing to do something, you know, to be changed. And I just knew I had to like kind of shake up things. So I stopped drinking in 87. I wasn't at the advanced stages, but it's like what the big book says. I was headed towards that. I was, you know, drinking in the afternoon and by myself to take the edge off. I guess like I used to eat, you know, the same thing. And my husband has been in AA since 86. I can't figure out how he went in a year before me, but anyway, that's what happened. And I joined Al-Anon. And Al-Anon made such a difference in my life. It still does. I still go to my Al-Anon meetings faithfully. And because I believe, for me, my codependency, which is what Al-Anon deals with, in other words, my insides are based on your outsides, and I feel that that's underneath all my addictions, whether it's a process addiction or a substance addiction, because I was, you know, shopping, spending, I call it retail therapy, you know, I go to the mall and to feel better. Anyway, I started HOW, and I became abstinent in around 87. And I lost about 65, 70 pounds, and I have been maintaining that weight loss. And it's funny, I just went to the doctor recently just for a checkup, and she said, you lost some more weight. You're at a good weight now, so just stay there. Of course, I don't, when is thin enough, you know? So to me, here's my thinking. My interpretation is, now you can eat whatever you want. You know, that's what I'm hearing her say, but she didn't say that at all. So anyway, I'm no longer HOW, but I do follow a specific plan. And I have a sponsor that I call pretty much every day. If I don't call her, I text her. And I don't weigh myself. I don't even own a scale. And because either way, when I got on the scale, if I lost weight, it was a reason to eat. And if I gained weight, it was a reason to eat. Either way, it was a reason to eat. So, and my clothes are also my barometer. So, and as far as my abstinence, I also would like to say that if I'm weighing, let's say chicken or whatever I'm weighing, if it's 3.9 or 4.1, I don't go crazy with that. I accept that. And again, it's not to say what's right or wrong. It's just, that's what I do. And then with struggling, then I met Janet at the Thursday night Ridgewood meeting. And we started studying the big book, and we would meet at Panera's. And then we got big. That seems to be what happens with Janet. You know, we start out small, and then it got bigger, and we would meet at Janet's home. And she helped with the big book so much, and I started seeing things. I spent 14 years in therapy, trying to find out why I ate, why they drank, because I really believed that self-knowledge was the key and I would be able to control all of that, my eating and my drinking, but self-knowledge isn't the answer. So that made it, I started reading things like The Doctor's Opinion and, well, all of the big book. And it was just wonderful. And it came alive to me. And that's what I live by. The last time I did a fourth step was, I think, either in 15 or 16. And I remember, I'm getting off what I want to say. Anyway, so we studied at Janet's, and it made a tremendous difference in my life. And then my oldest son, let me say that when I was working, I'm retired now, but I was a paralegal, and I was really very good at it. And I worked for large corporations, then I worked in private practice, and I was really sharp. And I say that, I don't know, not to brag on myself, but anyway, I was. So very detail oriented. And then my oldest son died in August of 2019. And all of a sudden, like, I used to be able to go from A to Z, connect those dots, boom, no problem. And then when he died, and he died from drug addiction. I don't know if I said that. And when he died, I couldn't go from A to B. And there are times now when I call them grief bursts, where all of a sudden I just can't function. I can't think. And I was so glad that didn't happen tonight. But anyway, Al-Anon has helped me and is helping me so much with that. And so anyway, let me see. I'd like to talk a little bit about step one. So I wrote down, when I find no solution to a problem, it's probably not a problem to be solved, but rather a truth to be accepted. So I had to accept my powerlessness over everything beyond the tip of my nose. And that's what I say to myself now. You know, if I want to know, is this my business? You know, if it's beyond the tip of my nose, it's not my business. And I always thought that conditions drove me to insane thoughts and behavior. And I tried to correct those conditions, and I found I couldn't, to my complete satisfaction. I became, and my life became, unmanageable. It never occurred to me that what needed changing was me in order to meet those conditions, whatever they were. So that's accepting powerlessness. That's accepting step one. I always blamed outside circumstances, people, places, and things for how I felt. If you didn't do this, I wouldn't be feeling this way. So it's your fault. And I realized I can't solve my problems with the same thinking that caused my problems. So, and when I ran out of my own ideas and what I was doing. So my disease, my spiritual malady, caused my unmanageability. It wasn't people, places, and things. It was my thinking. It was my disease. And then I thought, you know, what the food does for me, it produces an effect, usually a distraction, not so much what it does to me. Gaining weight wasn't enough for me to stop. It just wasn't. Well, of course, I was powerless too. But when the food stopped doing for me, then I thought, oh my God, what am I supposed to do? And that's, of course, when I went into alcohol and stuff like that. But so I stopped. One of the things that I do, and I think I said, I come from a very big Italian family, and I stopped cooking our favorite Italian foods because I found that it was just too much of a trigger. I cannot make meatballs, and I cannot make chicken parm without going nuts. So I don't do it anymore. I have a safe house, and my husband has some stuff, but it's separate and apart from mine. And I don't tempt myself. So I feel my feelings rather than trying to control them, especially grief and mourning. Grief is my feeling, and mourning is what I do with those feelings. And I have some very safe people that I share with. about my grief and what I'm going through. Safe people, meaning that it's people that don't try to fix it or change it. Just kind of listen. I learned that through this whole thing. I became a very good listener since my son died. So I have this spiritual void that I always tried to fix with things, people, places, and things. And it just never worked. It just never worked. So I read someplace about detachment is letting go of my need to control. And I would distract myself with my plans and my scheming and my profound ideas. And I would get these ideas and I would believe they really were so good, so wonderful. Profound is the word that I use. And I would figure that you would want to know what I'm thinking so that you can improve yourself. And I would tell you what I was thinking. You didn't ask. So now, and I always tell this to my daughter, who's Teresa, by the way, famous Teresa. And I always say, and I listen for a question, you know, is there a question in there? Is she saying, or anybody, not just my kids, but anybody, what do you think? I very seldom hear that, very seldom hear that. And so I try not to give my opinion unless I hear a question, like, what do you think? Because unsolicited advice is really criticism. And I realize that. I don't want to be critical. So step two, was I ever sane? First of all, I don't know. I'm looking at the clock here. 8:19. Okay. Do I recognize miracles in my life? And I must live by spiritual principles, and I do that through grace. The main thing that I like to share, I always believed in God, but I didn't believe what God said, that he was all love and wanted to help me. And I just never really gave him that chance. I certainly do now. I give him that. I ask for him, grace. I have two cats, and they're Maisie and Gracie. Amazing Grace. I mean, I have a plaque, Amazing Grace. I mean, that's what I believe in. So God doesn't ask me to understand him and his ways. He just asks me to trust and surrender. So God didn't become a reality to me until he became a necessity. I really needed him. So, and also I believe I'm restored to sanity, not perfection. I am far from perfect. Step three, I work step three by doing the rest of the steps. I make that decision to do 4 through 12. It was like we went to visit my granddaughter a couple of years back, and she lives in California. And in order to get there, I had to make plans, buy tickets, etc. And if I don't take the action, you know, just making a decision isn't, I need action. It's action that says that I have changed. So, okay. So then I did 4 through 9 with my sponsor. And I remember her saying to me, is there anyone that you feel you will definitely not make amends to? And I said, oh yeah, again, my ex-daughter-in-law, no way. I said, and these are my words, I hate her. And so she said, well, you know what? Let's see how you feel after you work the steps and when you get to 9. And she said to me, I'd like you not to talk negatively about her. And I said, not even to my husband? Because we would get together and just bash her. And we would re-feel and resent over and over. And when I went out to California, I knew that I had to make amends. And when we walked into the house, I said to her, can I talk to you a moment? And she said, yes. And I said, I would like to apologize for the part that I played in the demise of our relationship. And she started crying. And she said, I was mean and cruel to you just because you're Michael's mother. And I wanted to say, you little shit, I knew it. I knew you were mean and cruel to me. But I didn't say that, thank God. I'm there to ask her forgiveness. So that was, that amends that I made changed my life. It was very difficult not to talk about her. And until this day, you know, that's, I don't, other than when I'm sharing something like this. And we have a working relationship now. It's amazing. We meet when she lives in North Carolina, but when she comes up here, we meet, we have lunch or dinner or whatever. And I have become a new person because I had to look at my part. I had to look at my part. And then one other thing, that was what I wanted to say about 9. 10, if I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me, and I know that. And so step 10 is lessons. Step 10 is all about lessons that I haven't learned. And step 11 is where I apply lessons. That's what the difference is. And then step 12, I just want to say that the day that my son died, I was in the hospital and I said, God, if you think that you're going to use me to help other people with the same or similar situation, you are wrong. Don't ask me. I'm not going to do it. I was beside myself. And of course, it's exactly what I do. I work with people from Al-Anon and I work with them through the big book. And I suggest that they say where the word drinking is, that they say thinking. And it's worked wonderfully. It's just worked wonderfully. I have two people now that I'm working with that way. And it's amazing, the transformation. So that's it. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you. So great to hear you. So great to hear you. And now, where do I find her? I would like to introduce Shannon from Canada. Well, I'll let her tell her story, but you look lovely and I'm excited to hear you.
Thank you. I wear lipstick tonight, just for you, Janet.
Thank you.
Okay, so let me just show a few photos, so just bear with me. This was last August at the Taj Mahal in India, and it should have been a great trip, but I was binging and purging the whole time. Okay. This was last November when I moved back to Canada. This pains me to show you. Okay. This was a few years ago. And this was when I was in London in 2017. And finally, this is today. This is today. So hopefully you can see that. Okay. So first, I just would like to thank everyone who does service for this group. Hopefully you can hear me okay. I'm a bit nervous, but God is here with me. Thank you everyone for doing service in this group. Janet, Melissa, Tanya, Amy, and everyone else, thank you so much. So what it was like. So I think I was always a compulsive eater. My earliest memories were of food, under-eating, overeating, and just complete obsession. I don't have a story that's unique. I used to think I was the only one who stole, who snuck, who felt shame, who purged, who dieted, and who obsessed, but I'm not. My childhood was a bit chaotic. I was constantly afraid. Fear was such a big deal. I was always stressed. My father would rage, for lack of a better word. I would hear his keys in the door when he would get home from work and my stomach would drop. My mother was always on the phone and preoccupied, and I found food as a way to numb myself when I felt nervous. My earliest shame memory was when I was in grade three, third grade, when my teacher weighed everyone in front of the class for gym class, and I was easily the heaviest kid in the class, and everyone laughed at me, and I came home and cried. My parents were both elite athletes. My dad, as a true Canadian, was a semi-professional hockey player, and my mom represented Canada in the Olympics. Sports were a big deal, and I had a natural talent. I loved soccer and ice hockey, and I could always score goals, but as I reached puberty, my weight was a bigger issue, and that impacted my game. My coaches constantly made comments, and I knew my parents were quite concerned and probably quite ashamed. My parents didn't know what to do with me. When I was 10, my dad made me hold a bucket of water to represent 15 pounds of excess weight that I carried. I was humiliated. That night I cried, I hid, and I snuck food. I pretty much destroyed Christmas every year. I would rip through the house knowing exactly where my mom would hide the Christmas baking. She would even wrap it in gift wrap, thinking that would deter me, but boy, was she wrong. Nothing would stop me. She would rightfully so freak out, and I would hate myself. As a 12-year-old, summers at the lake house included me binging and purging into the lake. My sister and friends who caught me would laugh, and I thought it was funny. As I approached grade 9, I discovered over-exercising and restriction. That summer, I lost 40 pounds, starving myself, eating diet pills, and spending 4 hours a day at the gym. Finally, I was cured, I thought. I lost the weight. I'm good. People noticed, too, with positive comments. My dad even said he was proud of me. If only they knew what I did to achieve this normal body weight, they would be horrified. My skin was changing color, my hair was falling out, and I had bad breath from restricting and diet pills. In grade 12, after spending a year abroad as an exchange student in Switzerland, I told my mom I was obsessed with food. I didn't know what that meant, but food was constantly on my mind. It was my master. I always thought, if only my dad didn't rage, if only my mom got off the phone and cooked us proper meals, made us proper lunches. But a lot of kids grow up in such circumstances who don't turn to the food. So now I know it's not my parents' fault. I cease blaming them. Maybe I was just, I think it's what, 1 in 10 compulsive eaters stamped as a baby. When I went to university, I hit, excuse the language, the fuck it button. And I ate, I drank, I smoked weed, I slept around, and I abused my body, and that really showed. In 2007, I found OA. A friend of mine got recovery in AA, and I thought, there's got to be something for food. I cannot be the only one who struggles with food. I was 220 pounds, and I lost 60 pounds in 6 months. And that followed with years of slipping and sliding, 2 to 5 years of abstinence, followed by relapse triggered by I called off a wedding, my wedding, not just any wedding, mine. I had huge bouts of depression and fear. And the big book says half measures availed us nothing. And that I have years and years of doing mediocre half measures, working a lackluster program in hopes I wouldn't take a compulsive bite, which would automatically trigger a binge and purge. I never fully got through all the steps. I would usually end after 8 or 9, just out of circumstance. I would constantly start over, and the selfish self-centeredness would always be in my heart. Fast forward to 2014, when I moved to London, and I continued to do half measures whilst attending meetings and selecting a sponsor who I knew would go easy on me. Again, I had 2 years of white knuckling abstinence. Then I relapsed, which those photos I showed. So I lost some weight in London, and then I hit a relapse in 2018. That year was the pinnacle of my relapse, and on weekends I would spend dodging plans I had made with my friends or getting drunk and spending Sundays ordering food to binge and purge. I tiptoed to the door, hoping my neighbors wouldn't see me constantly greeting the food delivery guys in my PJs. Another bad relationship added to this relapse. Well, it was an affair. As well as longstanding resentment to my boss, my former boss, for promising me a promotion that didn't come to fruition. That single resentment nearly killed me. I was so angry. I had significant fantasies about hanging myself at work just to get back at them. And after 5 years in London, I felt desperate and fearful as my impending repatriation date to Canada was fast approaching. I've let fear run riot in my life. It has been the root of many bad decisions and self-centered self-pity that pushed me to the food. The Big Book, page 69, bottom of page says, "Fear is an evil and corroding thread. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble." So when I read that sentence about stealing, I read it the first time this summer. That really hit me. I've let fear control me, which is as bad as stealing. I never thought of it that way. It stole years of my life, it stole my peace of mind, it stole my body, it stole potential opportunities and relationships. So this time last year, I returned to Canada, sunny Vancouver, and I did 6 months of half measures in local meetings. And we all know that faith without work is dead. I hit another rock bottom in July when I was binging and purging while driving, purging into like a big cup. I thought to myself, if I crash my car, how would I explain all the vomit in the interior? I called Janet shortly after, and she said I would use that story to help others. So there it is, and I hope it can help you. The doctor's opinion states, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So the hospitalization period for me looked like canceling my summer holiday, weighing and measuring my food, 3 calls a day, 1 meeting a day, 30 minutes with God, and strenuous step work. No social events, no restaurants, just work, program, yoga, sleep, repeat. Those handrails gave me structure to focus on recovery and not just on abstinence. It was scary, and Lord knows I wasn't perfect. I struggled with honesty. I had lots of breakdowns, then breakthroughs. I messed around with my food after a month, and it took me a while to be honest about that. But when I did have that breakdown, I was grateful for the breakthrough that followed. God protected me. I abstained from alcohol. I was protecting through and through. I was protected through and through. Step one was easy. As the Big Book says, I was the real deal compulsive eater. Absolutely no question. My life was so unmanageable. I was and still am facing a redundancy at work, which I could barely ever accept. Now it's still looming, but I don't fret. God takes care of that. Step two, God could restore me to sanity. There is a solution. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make the beginning. I learned that God was always there. It was me who turned my back on God's direction. I could finally hear God again. Step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. it was such an abstract thing, but I envisioned a rope from my hand to God, and that works for me. And I still envision it when I'm meditating and when I'm in yoga. God is powerful, God is strong, and God cares about me. He's not shaming me for my mistakes. He's not punishing me. He has my best interests and he's got it all sorted. I don't know what my future will bring, but if I'll get married, have kids, or if my career will progress. But when that fear creeps up again, I turn that over in a tenth step. I just turn it over to God. And maybe I won't get married or have kids. Maybe my career won't progress. It's God's plan. It's God's plan. And I can no longer pray to God as a transaction. I now have a relationship with God. I do the footwork. I update my resume. I hand it to God, and God's got it all sorted. I let go. I take it easy. I turn my thoughts to others, and I make phone calls. This has brought me so much freedom. My defect of fear used to baffle me. I was a slave, and now I turn my thoughts to how I can help others. I pray for God's will, not mine, in all my affairs. When the self-will does creep back in, as it occasionally does, I stop, acknowledge it, and pray to God to remove it. Selfish self-centeredness is the root of my troubles. I am like that actor, a control freak, obsessed with ego, obsessive and angry when I don't get my way. Sharing my fourth step inventory was liberating and painful. I no longer needed to hide all the bad things I've done in my life. I could let go and forgive myself because I know God forgave me. When I was in my early 20s, I stole food, alcohol, and cash from my employer. I looked them up. I had a bank draft ready and prepared. And I was ready to send them $1,000. That's Canadian dollars, so it doesn't really count for much. But anyways, I shoplifted Disneyland when I was 15. And I wrote their charity a check. I also shoplifted when I was living in Switzerland, which was absolutely reckless. If I was ever caught, I would have been sent home. I now sponsor a child in Africa. I feel grateful and useful. And I want to talk about my ninth step. I made a direct amends to my parents. I read them a letter asking for forgiveness for the years I shut them out of my life. I was so abusive to my mom. I really was. Years and years of trying to make her pay for all the pain I felt like she caused me. The years of anger, always blaming them for my eating disorder. My last 2 years in London, I was so resentful, I barely texted them. I can see now how painful it must be for parents when a child withdraws. When I read them the letter, we all cried, including my 74-year-old father. The big book says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Since mid-July, I am down 25 pounds. And while my fat cells have decreased, my spiritual program has increased. When the obsession with my physical self creeps back in, and again, I pray to God to lift that. Submitting myself to the program was easy when I hit that rock bottom. God helped me show up, shut up, and just do the work. So I want to close on the promises. The ninth step, excuse me, Joanne just clicked your... The ninth steps promises, page 84, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I'm no longer consumed by fear. I no longer feel like I'm wasting my life. I can be present with my fellows. I no longer feel that consuming resentment to my company. When it rears its ugly head, I do a 10th step on it. I look at my part and I take it easy. I'm excited about the future. I jump out of bed, excited to talk to my fellows or to go to yoga. I'm smiling. It's been a while since I've smiled. My spirit and body are a gift. After all the years of abuse, my body still manages to carry me from A to B with effortless ease. And after thinking no one could love me or handle my messy self, I have the confidence to open up my heart to a partner. I am a child of God. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've stolen, I've cheated, I've had affairs, I've lied, you name it. And I've learned from those experiences. I've made mistakes, but I am not a mistake. I'm not regretting or ashamed of my existence. God did for me what I could not do for myself. I'm grateful to be back in Canada and not stuck in my shoebox apartment in London, especially during COVID. I was dreading moving back to Canada, and now I am so grateful to be here, to be with my family and friends. I'm grateful I didn't follow through on any suicidal ideation. God gives me hope. God has a plan for me. I can't see it just yet, but I trust him. And I'm Shannon. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and bulimic. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the first time Shannon's ever spoken, shared her story like that. Wonderful. A real testimony to the grace and power and love of God. So thank you. Thank you both for sharing.